But what is addition?
Okay.
Welcome.
Thank you. Now, one is just because it's the first page. There is a second page to the handout. Maybe I'll just start sort of going backwards on the abstract. So really, I got to this subject from a completely different direction. So, you know, if I am to start with Witten, then there was the Chern-Simons theory, and then there was perturbation theory for Chern-Simons theory, and it turned out to be a universal finite type invariant. And then at some later point, for various reasons, I decided that I'm interested in universal finite type invariants of so-called virtual knots or W knots. And at some point, things got to be too complicated, and I needed a baby example in which I could actually do computations. And the baby example in which I can actually do computations is what I'm going to talk about today. I've spoken about the W theory and the V theory in many other places, and many of these lectures are videotaped, as is this one, and are on my website. For now, I'm just going to talk about one sort of small projection of one of these big theories. And the fun property of this projection, which I will call beta calculus, just because for my own reasons. So the fun property of this beta calculus is that it produces a version of the Alexander polynomial, or an extension of the Alexander polynomial, which in some sense is better than anything else out there about the Alexander polynomial. Okay? So that's the reason for my talk. My talk will follow a handout. Here it is in front of you. I think you all have copies, but if not, there are further copies over here. And I should also apologize and say that the talk involves extremely ugly formulas, and here are the worst. Okay? So the conceptual framework is lovely, well, and is conceptual, okay? But at the end, there are formulas. And the formulas are ugly and unmotivated. I know where they came from. They came from this W calculus, from this expansion for W knots, but this will not show today. On the good side, these formulas are at the level that any high school student can understand. I mean, all there is here is matrices, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, and various silly things that you do to their elements. It's only that, so I mean, you multiply them, you divide by something, I don't know. It's elementary operations with rational functions. Very, very basic things. The only bad thing about this is that it's extremely unmemorable, okay? However, the results are good. And let me start. So I want to talk about an invariant of knots. So I want to talk about knots. This is the knot 817. And even more so, I want to talk about tangles. So it's a knot theory conference. I probably don't need to define it. But nevertheless, a tangle is a piece of a knot drawn within a disk. Okay, and it may have some boundary piece, so some parts, some strands that go to the boundary of the disk. And the reason I care very much about tangles is because in some sense they are the basic ingredients from which knots are made. Every knot is the gluing together of many tangles. And if you understand tangles rather than just knots as a whole, then it allows you various powers. So it allows you the divide and conquer power. If you want to compute something big, you can cut it in pieces and compute each piece on the side, perhaps more quickly, and then assemble the computations. But the pieces of a knot will be tangles. And if you want to prove something about knots, again, often you may want to first divide the knot into pieces, and then the pieces are tangles. So it's always good to have an extension of your invariants to invariants of tangles. Now, maybe I should just indicate that my tangle. So what is a tangle? So a tangle is a collection of crossings drawn in the plane, in a disk, sorry, which is allowed to, in which some strands are allowed to go to the boundary, and the crossings are all either positive or negative, and there is a standard convention, and I will not remind you what it is, I'm just reminding you that there is a convention, and some crossings are positive, and some crossings are negative. Okay? Except this is a lie, because I want the topology underlying the tangle, so I want to take such pictures as this, and mod them out by the so-called Rademeister moves. The Rademeister moves are the Rademeister 1 move, which says that you can remove a king, the Rademeister 2 move, which says that this is equal to that, and the Rademeister 3 move, and I'm sure you've all seen it, so I will not say what it does, but whatever I do to tangles has to be invariant under these moves. Except, if you notice, Rademeister 1 is drawn in gray, because it's less important. Oftentimes in knot theory we forget Rademeister 1 because it turns out that you don't lose very much by forgetting it, and sometimes formulas become simpler. This is the case for me too, so forget Rademeister 1. Okay, and now the idea. So here is an idea how given any group and some elements in it, I can produce a knot invariant. Okay? So let G be a group, and let there be two so-called Young-Baxter pairs, R plus and R minus. Each one is a pair of elements in the group, so it's in G squared, and let's call them GO plus, GU plus, this will be R plus, and R minus will be GO minus, GU minus. Okay? And then the way I will construct the invariant is, well, I will look at my big tangle, and everywhere I see a crossing, if it's a plus crossing, I will put the plus elements on it. And if it's a minus crossing, I will put the minus elements on it. And what I mean by putting elements on it is I will mark G sub O on the over strand. Sorry, so this should have been O and this should have been U. Okay, so I will mark G sub O on the over strand and G sub U on the under strand. Okay, and then my invariant will be just to multiply these elements along the strands of the knot. So for example, if you start from the tangle we had before, this is a tangle which is made of two strands, so the invariant will be two big products of group elements. And let's read what they are. So over here, I see a G plus over. Then I see a G plus under. Then I see a G plus over. So I get G plus O, G plus U, G plus O, and so on. I get a product of elements in the group. And likewise, for the second strand, I will get a G U minus G U, G, G O minus. Here it is. And that's my invariant, or my proposed invariant. Now, if it were to be an invariant, it would have to be invariant under the Rademeister moves, and you can check very carefully that once you try to find such elements, such four elements in a group, that's so that the Rademeister moves will be satisfied, everything collapses to silliness. So basically, Rademeister 2 will imply that GO plus times GO minus is the identity, and that GU plus times GU minus is the identity. So the things with minuses are the inverses of the things with pluses. Then you look at Rademeister 3 and you write it, expand it out, and you find that it implies that GO plus and GU plus commute with each other. So if all of these elements commute, then really it's the invariant is just a counting invariant. You just count how many times you go over and how many times you go under. And when you look at it very carefully, it turns out to be even weaker than the linking number. It's not even the linking number. It's really the sum of so the invariant for a given strand will be the sum of its linking numbers with all the other strands. Okay? So it's even weaker than the linking matrix of the tangle. So that's a failure. Okay, but let me generalize the notion of a group. And once I generalize the notion of a group a little bit, it works. I get a lovely result. So first of all, I want to explain what's a metagroup. Okay, and a metagroup is something that has some of the properties of the group of a group, but not all. But to explain what these properties are, I guess I first have to tell you a little bit of a different perspective of how to view a group. Okay? So let me tell you what a group computer is. So a group computer is a machine, okay? I don't know, maybe it looks like this one, okay? But it has registers in which it can store group elements. Okay, so here is, well, actually, this is not a group computer. This is a particular data set that a group computer could work on. And in this data set, there are four registers. The register called X, the register called U, the register called V, and the register called Y. And they store, respectively, the group element G1, G2, G3, and G4. Overall, the set of all such data sets in which the registers are called X, U, V, and Y is the group G raised to the power of the finite set X, U, V, Y. Okay, these are data sets, but the computer can also do operations. The operation, so the most sort of the best operation, the most important operation is the operation M, X, Y, Z. And it's the operation that takes the content of the register X and the content of the register Y, multiplies them, removes them, and stores the result in a register Z. So the result will be a data set in which U and V are unchanged, X and Y disappeared, and instead we have a new register, C, which stores G1, G4. And this data set is an element in G up U, V, Z. Okay? Now, this is the most, this operation, M, X, Y, Z, satisfies various silly properties. So the fact that the group law is associative implies that if you multiply X and Y, store the result in U, and then multiply U by Z and store the result in V, then this is the same as multiplying Y and Z and storing the result in U, and then multiplying X and U and storing the result in V. If you wonder what double slash is, double slash is newspeak for circle. So circle is composition, except composition is always interpreted in the wrong order, from right to left. So double slash is composition done right. Okay? That's all. Completely notational point. Okay? Well, that's not all that a group computer ought to have. A group computer also should have an operation S sub X for inverting the element in register X, an operation E sub X for inserting the unit in a register X. So the register X must not exist in the data set before. And then if you apply E sub X to a data set, it will become a bigger data set in which there is a new register called X, which stores the identity. Then there is an operation D sub X for dropping one of the registers, and an operation delta ZXY, which takes the register in the element in the register Z and clones it and puts a copy in the register X and the register Y. And finally, I need an operation row XY, which just renames register X to register Y. Okay? And then there are, finally, there is a disjoint union operation, which does the following. If you have two data sets whose register names are disjoint, you can combine them, and you get a bigger data set whose set of registers is or whose set of register labels is the union of the two sets of labels. Everything is clear? Is it clear what a group computer is? It's very, very simple, okay? Anyway, but then there are many, many, many axioms that these operations should, that these operations satisfy. One axiom I already stated. It's not at all hard to list the rest, but let me show you one exceptional axiom. It's this axiom here, the one written down here. So if you have a data set P, which contains two elements, so an element denoted X and it's G1, an element in the register Y and it's G2, then the then P is actually equal to take P and delete Y, so you're only left with X, and take P and delete X, so you're only left with Y, and then take the union of these two data sets. Okay? So a pair is equal to delete the second element, comma, delete the first element. That's a well-known, you know, that's a clearly a property. Okay? But this property is somehow quadratic in the data set. The data set appears once on the left, but twice on the right. Okay? Whereas the property that appeared here is linear in the data set. So I didn't even bother to write the data set here. But you take an instance of the data set, applies operations to it, and it's equal to taking a single instance of the data set and applying other operations to it. Okay? So I just wanted to make this distinction. It's a distinction from logic between sort of linear axioms and higher and axioms that are not linear. Anyway, what's a metagroup? So a metagroup is a similar computer, except we don't really know what's inside the data sets. We only know that the data sets are labeled by finite sets. So for every finite set, which you think of as a set of registers, there is a data set, okay? Or there is a collection of data sets. So essentially, for every finite set X, there will be some collection G sub X of data sets, okay? And in the group case, in the ordinary group case, this collection would be G sub X, sorry, G to the power X. But now I'm not insisting that it will be G to the power X. It could be something else, okay? And then there are lots of operations. So if there are elements X and Y in here, and an element Z, which is not in here, you'll have an operation multiplying X and Y and putting the output in Z, and this will be an operation which goes from G sub X to G sub X minus X and Y union Z. Okay? So again, a metagroup will be a collection of set G sub X indexed by all finite sets, and the collection of operations, and I've explained what MX, Y, Z is, but all the rest are similar, okay? Except sometimes I will not have the cloning operations, but I don't think I want to say when I will and when I will not, because the cloning operation will not be relevant for what I will talk about today. And the disjoint and the union operation, so I can merge to I can merge two data sets. And I want it to satisfy the exact same linear properties. Okay? The same linear axioms. So this should be satisfied in any metagroup, but this need not be satisfied in an arbitrary metagroup. Okay? If that was satisfied, by the way, it would follow that G sub two elements is G sub one element squared. So the metagroup would be a group. But I'm not insisting that this will be satisfied in a metagroup. I suppose I have to give you examples. So the first example is the non-meta example, which I already indicated. So take G sub X to be G to the power X. Okay? Okay. The second example will be, I guess I can erase this. So, G sub x will be the set of all matrices which are x by x. So in other words, whose rows and columns are labeled by elements of x. The operations, you know, I have to tell you what all operations are, but I will only tell you what the interesting ones are. So the multiply two registers operation will be, well, if you want to multiply, say, x1 and x2, what you do is you add column 1 and column 2, but at the same time, add row 1 and row 2. So it becomes a matrix, which is small, well, it becomes a smaller matrix, but still square. Okay? And you label the result with Z. You label the new column row that are generated, you label them Z. So this is the multiplication operation. And the union operation is the block diagonal merge of two matrices. So if you have two matrices with disjoint label sets, so this is one and this is the other, their union will be the block diagonal matrix in which the first one appears here and the second one appears down here. You can check that all axioms are satisfied. All linear axioms are satisfied. You can also check that this axiom is not satisfied, and therefore this metagroup is not a group. Okay? So let's check that this axiom is not satisfied. So if you have a 2x2 matrix labeled X and Y, it will be a matrix whose entries are A, B, C, D. D sub Y of this matrix, let's call it P. So D sub Y of P will be, if you delete the row and column corresponding to Y, you'll get the 1x1 matrix A. D sub X of P will be the 1x1, so if I delete X, I will be left with D. It will be the 1x1 matrix D. If I take the union of these two things, I will get the 2x2, the block diagonal union of these two things, I will get the 2x2 matrix AD, A00D, and this is not the matrix I started from.
Can you draw that a little higher? Just the very last.
Draw that a little bit
just
higher?
The last matrix.
So this is A00D, which is not the matrix I started from. So therefore, this metagroup is not an honest group. Okay? Now, if I had... Oops, what have I done? What have I done? No, no, no. Good. No, not good. Sorry. Okay. So, if I had, in addition to the metagroup, two so-called Young Baxter elements, so both leaving, so one element corresponding to the overcrossing and one element corresponding to the undercrossing, and if these crossings are labeled X and Y, then this element should live in the metagroup corresponding to having two group elements, the metagroup space corresponding to having two group elements, so G sub X comma Y. Okay, so if I had two such Young Baxter elements, I could try to construct a knot invariant. How? Well, I will go through the knot and label the crossings as I go through them, but labeling each one twice, once for the under and once for the over. So if I go through 817, I will have a label 1 here, and then a label 2 here for the over strand here, a label 3 here, a label 4 for the upper strand here, 5 for the lower strand here, and so on. Each crossing is now labeled twice. Take the young Baxter elements you were given and store them in registers 1 and 12. And then take another copy of the young Baxter element and store it in registers 2 and 7, and so on. What it really means is that you take the single data set and take its multiple union, because a union is one of the operations that are allowed that are given in a meta group. And then multiply these elements along the strands. So multiply the elements in 1 and 2 and store the result in 1. Then multiply it with the element in 3 and store the result in 1. Then multiply it with the element in 4 and store the result in 1, and keep going until the whole product is stored in 1. And that would be your suggested invariant. Okay? And when I say multiply, I don't really mean multiply. I mean apply the metagroup operation which corresponds to multiplication. Okay. Well, I could give you examples. I could tell you that in this example, there are young Baxter elements, and the corresponding invariant is the complete linking matrix of the tangle. So, I mean, it's more interesting than before, but it's still not very interesting. Okay? But now I want to tell you about a more complicated metagroup that gives the Alexander polynomial. Now, just like in group theory, you know, I mean, the first three groups that you construct in algebra 1, you construct them by hand, okay? You say, I don't know, symmetries of the triangle, okay? But after that, you need to have tools. You need to know what the product of two groups are, or the semi-direct product of two groups, or whatever, okay? So I need to tell you about a tool from ordinary group theory. And the tool is called the bicross product of two groups. So my plan is to tell you about this tool in ordinary group theory, and then tell you that it has an analog in metagroup theory, and then use this analog to construct the metagroup that I like, that I want to tell you about. Okay? So suppose you have a group G, which is the product of two of its subgroups, and that these two subgroups are disjoint. So their intersection is just the identity. Okay? But I'm not saying that this is a direct product. Okay? You can easily check that if G is equal to H times T, then it's also equal to T times H. Which means that given any pair of elements T, H, so given any pair T, H, you can find another pair H prime T prime such that TH is H prime T prime. This is the so-called swap operation. It's the operation that swaps from writing things as a product in T times H to writing things as a product in H times T. Now, this swap operation has properties. So, is it clear what the swap operation is? So, this swap operation has properties. And it's best if I just tell you what they are symbolically. So, by the way, my convention is that the group H stands for heads and the group T stands for tail, and I draw heads in red and tails in blue. Okay? And then the axiom for the swap operation. Well, actually, there are various axioms that are kind of minor, how it behaves relative to the identity. But sort of the big axioms for the swap operation are that if you want to swap a head over a product of two tails, you could do it by first swapping it over the second tail and then over the first tail. And only then multiplying those two tails. Symbolically, what?
Crossing of two lines is a slope operation.
Yes, so in this picture, the crossing, it has nothing to do with knot theory. Okay, that has nothing to do with knot theory. It's just the crossing of two It's the swap operation. So again, a vertex stands for multiplying, a crossing stands for swap, and then multiplying and then swapping is the same as swapping the two and then multiplying. And if you want the symbolic notation of the previous or a notation like the notation I used before, tail multiply followed by swap is the same as swap and then followed by another swap followed by tail multiply, and believe me that the indices make sense. Likewise, there is a second axiom which I did not write explicitly, which says that head multiplying and then swapping is the same as swapping and then head multiplying. And these are the fun axioms. Then there are minor axioms as well, which I will not quote. Okay? So the point is that if you have, so now suppose you had two groups, H and T. So now let's go backward and try to construct G from H and T. So suppose you had two groups, H and T, and a swap map, which goes from T times H to H times T, and the swap map satisfies these two axioms as well as the minor ones, then this is enough to put a group structure on the Cartesian product of H and T. But it's not the Cartesian group structure. It's the group structure that sort of simulates this one. How does it work? So maybe this one is actually better when you write it in letters. So suppose I wanted to know how to multiply H back. Suppose I wanted to know how to multiply H1 T1 with H2 T2. Well, all I need to know is to learn how to swap these two. So I swap these two and write it as H1 H2 prime T1 prime T2. And then I multiply in the head group and in the tails group. Or if you want to see it symbolically, if I want to multiply a head-tail pair with another head-tail pair, I swap and then multiply in the head group and in the tail group. Okay? So now, what's a metabi cross product? So a metabi cross product is, first of all, a pair of meta groups. So it's a computer that has two types of memory registers, one that can store heads and another that can store tails. So for every finite set heads of sort of head labels and every finite set of tail labels, you get a set beta HT, and then you get operations. Well, if x and y are tails and z is a new tail, you'll get an operation tail multiply from x, y to z, into store the result in z. Likewise, there is an operation h head multiply x, y store the result in z. This is when x and y and z are names for heads. And then there are the and then you must have an additional operation, the swap operation, and the swap operation acts on a pair XY, and so it on a data set, on a pair of registers XY, where X is a tail and Y is a head, and it outputs into the same registers the result of the swap. Okay? And then you want these tail multiply and head multiply and the swap operation and the lesser ones to satisfy the axioms written above, right? And these axioms, if you look at them, are linear, so they fall into the same sort of meta language. And then the point is, the theorem is, or the minor theorem is, that given these three data elements, so a tail multiply, a head multiply, and a swap, you can construct a meta group. And the meta group is the meta analog of h times t, of g equals h times t of before, and also the meta-analog of the process I did here. And really what it means is that if you want to store x elements of g, you need x tails and x head, sorry, x heads and x tails, because each element is a pair, head tail. And then the group multiply operation on g sub x, which is beta xx, will be given by this combination written here, which precisely comes from this picture, from this formula here. Are you with me? I mean, in a sense, it's empty until I show you an example. So here's the example. And I'm afraid this example is a messy one. But that's what I have. So let beta ht be the following. Okay? So it's the set of h by t matrices. In fact, t by h matrices. No, sorry, what do you count first? The rows or the columns?
Rows.
Rows? So it's the set of t by h matrices. So it's the set of arrays whose rows are labeled by tail labels and whose columns are labeled by head labels. And in fact, there is an extra element which I put here and I call it omega. All of these elements are to be rational functions. Oops, I wrote something here, not Laurent polynomials, but rational functions in variables capital T sub I, where these variables themselves are in a bijection with the set of tails. Why? Because I say so. Okay? So this is sort of, this should represent, this is like having a data set with labels H's and T's. Now I have to tell you what tail multiply is, what head multiply is, what all the other operations are. So I'll do only the ones that I really need. So first of all, I guess the union operation for two data sets, the way you take the union of two data sets is you replace the here alpha 1 is one data set and it really represents the whole matrix of Laurent polynomial, of rational functions. And alpha 2, likewise, is a matrix of rational functions. And then the matrix corresponding to merging the two data sets is the block, it's the block diagonal union of matrices. And the two exceptional elements, omega 1 and omega 2, get multiplied. I have nothing good to say about it, except it comes from somewhere.
Works.
And it works.
So
yes.
Group where all the elements are is fixed Russell curl.
Sorry?
Group where all these elements are, including omega, is fixed curl.
Oh, the group? No, so these entries, so the entry of the matrix are are rational functions of variables t sub I. With coefficients in the integers, I should have said that.
And omega is also rational function.
What?
Omega.
Omega is also. So the alpha ij and omega are all rational functions. Okay. Then I have to tell you what the tail multiply operation. So the tail multiply is inspired by the operation from one of the groups we had before. So basically, you just if you want to combine two tails, you just add the corresponding rows, and at the same time, identify the corresponding variables throughout. So remember that these things are rational functions with invariables corresponding to the tails. So just take the variable corresponding to x and the variable corresponding to y, and replace both of them by the variable corresponding to z. It sort of drops the number of variables in all of these rational functions. Okay, then comes head multiply. So head multiply is already more complicated. So if I want to do the operation corresponding to multiplying these two heads, so here I have a column, and here I have a column. Alpha and beta are columns of rational functions. And gamma is the remainder. It's a whole matrix of other rational functions. So the way I combine these two is a bit non-linear. So I take alpha plus beta, just like here, but then I add bracket alpha times beta. Bracket alpha is defined here. It's just the sum of the entries of that column. You cannot argue. Sorry, that's the way it is. Finally, there is a swap operation. The swap operation takes us an input. Oh, by the way, sorry, I should have said tail multiply and head multiply did not touch omega. The swap operation is the only operation that does. So the swap operation takes as an input a matrix with a special, a distinguished row Tx and a distinguished column Hy. And it does the thing corresponding to swap. There is no actual swapping here. It's just a formula, okay? Anyway, the matrix will have alpha a scalar, beta a row vector, gamma a column vector, and delta a sort of matrix of size one less. And then it will map them to the following. First of all, you will set epsilon to be 1 plus alpha, and then you will put, instead of alpha, you will put alpha times 1 plus the norm of gamma, meaning just the sum of entries of gamma, divided by epsilon. Likewise for beta, and then you'll put here gamma divided by epsilon, and finally in the lower left, lower right corner, you'll put delta, so you'll just copy delta, minus gamma times beta. So gamma is a column vector, beta is a row vector, you multiply them, you get a matrix of size 1 less. So take the product of these two matrices, divide by epsilon, and that's what you put here. Why? Because I say so. And sorry, and you multiply omega by epsilon. Okay. And finally, I claim more. Not only I have constructed a meta bicross product, there are actually two Young Baxter elements in it. So there is the positive Young Baxter element, which should be an element in the meta group on two labels. The meta group on labels, the meta group space corresponding to two labels X and Y should have two tails X and Y and two heads X and Y, and I should be giving you a 2x2 matrix of rational functions, and here it is. Okay? Likewise for the negative Young Baxter element. And here is my claim. My claim is, first of all, this really is a meta-bicross product, so all axioms are satisfied. Second, you can construct Z up beta. I think I failed to give the invariant a name previously. Let me give it a name now. So you can construct Z up beta, as I stated before, from those Young Baxter elements using the metagroup multiplication, and the result, when restricted to naught, the omega part is the Alexander polynomial and the remaining is not interesting. When restricted to links, it contains the multivariable Alexander polynomial, though I didn't tell you how, but it does. And when restricted to braids, it's essentially equivalent to the Birao representation and it has lots of other good properties, and I will briefly tell you what they are, perhaps, later. Why am I happy? I mean, the formulas are undeniably ugly. So why am I nevertheless happy? Well, first of all, because it does what I wanted it to be originally. I mean, I wanted to play with it in a different context, and it does that, but I cannot explain what exactly I wanted, and I cannot explain what the play is, so let's ignore this piece. The second point is that, in some sense, it's the least wasteful Alexander invariant for tangles. First of all, I like invariant of tangles, and I think I already explained why. Secondly, if you look at the Alexander polynomial for tangles, well, there are various proposed or possible definitions for the Alexander invariant of tangles, and they're all much more wasteful. They all take values in some sort of tensor powers of some vector space. Or maybe in a skein module. Or maybe in some exterior algebra. but they always take values in some space whose sort of number of coefficients is exponential. Whereas the space I work with is just a space of matrices. So in some sense, it's much more compact. It doesn't waste anything. It stores only what you really need to store, and no more. Or at least not a lot more. Okay? And yet, it contains the multivariable Alexander polynomial and the Alexander polynomial. So, I mean, you don't lose everything. I mean, you keep what you want and you don't store too much. Even more interesting, so, you know, people like to say that the Alexander polynomial has an honest, lovely topological interpretation, and in some sense, it's right. It's the order of some module or something. But in some other sense, in some computational sense at least, it's completely wrong. Because how is the Alexander polynomial ordinarily defined? Well, you create a certain n by n matrix, and then you take the determinant. The determinant, what?
That's not how it is defined.
Oh, maybe it's not how it is defined, okay, but this is how it is in practice. So you see, there is always a definition between the formula and the narrative. The narrative is something about orders of modules, okay? In practice, the formula is to compute the determinant. Computing the determinant is not a topological operation. To compute the determinant, you either sum over n factorial terms, each of which has no meaning whatsoever, or you do Gaussian elimination, and along the way you get all sorts of matrices that again have no meaning whatsoever. Okay? Whereas my invariant is a product is a certain product, okay? But each step along the computation is simply the invariant of the tangle. Where should I go? There. Sorry, so each step along the computation is meaningful, right? The first step is just the first step of just taking the full data set without computing any multiplication is just the invariant of the silly tangle that is made of 8 crossings that are not connected to each other. Then you start multiplying things and you get invariants of various tangles that are subtangles of the knot you at the end want to compute.
You mean that for braids it's literally how you compute Brouwer representation?
So for braids it's like the Brouwer representation. It amounts to the Brouwer representation. But if you use the Brouwer representation to compute an Alexander invariant, you know, you do lovely things, Brouwer, 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 and at the end, the determinant, and the determinant is topologically meaningless, or at least geometric, I don't know, it has no meaning to me, okay? Whereas, here, every step along the computation is the invariant of something. You never compute something which isn't the invariant of some picture, okay? So that's the second reason why I like it. And the third reason why I like it is that the whole story maybe is messy, but it fits on one sheet of paper, including the implementation. And being the painful bastard that I am, I will show you the implementation. Okay? So the implementation is in, so I mean business, okay? The implementation is written in a language called Mathematica. I first have to load some utilities. Believe me, these do nothing but typesetting. So the content is not in the utilities. So input utilities, enter, they've been entered, we can move on. So the key implementation trick is the way I represent a matrix like this is by an ordered pair. So omega is exceptional, so it's the ordered pair omega and then capital lambda, where lambda is some quadratic polynomial, which is defined as follows. I introduced new formal variables, ti, h, and hj, and instead of storing the matrix alpha ij, I store the sum of alpha ij, ti, hj, and call it lambda. And clearly, such quadratic polynomials contain the same amount of information as matrices. And the point is that it's a bit easier to work with these things. For example, if you want to know the sum of a column, the sum of a column, you just have to replace all the t's by one. So hence, bracket of a mu is defined to be mu in which all t's are replaced by one. Next, what's tail multiply? So tail multiply was defined to be merging two rows, but this just amounts to merging their labels, while at the same time merging the corresponding variables. Then there is head multiply. So for head multiply, if you look at the formulas, I have to identify what alpha is, what beta is, and what gamma is. What the column of x is, that's alpha, the column of y is, that's beta, and the column of, and the rest, that's gamma. So the column of x is just the derivative of lambda with respect to h sub x. The column of y is the derivative of lambda with respect to h sub y, and the rest is what you get when you take lambda and you replace h of x or y by zero. So now I have alpha beta of gamma, and my output is b of omega, and then alpha plus 1 plus bracket of alpha times beta, all of this multiplied by hz, and you, to this you add gamma. That's exactly the formula I said before. I think I don't want to go through the whole swap thing, but you know, the first thing is to identify what alpha, beta, gamma, and delta are, and it's done in the same way. Then you set epsilon to be 1 plus alpha, and then you just copy the formulas from before. And finally, you define group multiply, the group multiply in which you take x and y and turn them into z, applied to beta, is just you apply the swap operations, then the head multiply, then the tail multiply. Okay? And finally, oh, this is the disjoint union operation, and then and finally, Z's are the two R matrices in my new notation. Okay? And I guess I have to check that the axioms are satisfied. So for example, let's check this this axiom. Tail multiplied followed by swap is two swaps followed by a tail multiply. So I take a beta, which is a generic element. So in fact, here is beta printed right here. And then I do two things. I either take beta and apply to it tail multiplied followed by a swap, or swap followed by a tail multiply, and I get either this matrix or that matrix, and you can stare at them for half an hour and you will find that they are the same. So indeed, I have a metacross product. Then I have to check the Rademeister move. Well, there are many to check, but I'll check just one, okay? The Rademeister 3. So here's one side of the Rademeister 3. So I need to create, I need to start with three copies of the R matrix. So a 1-5 copy, a 2-6 copy, and a copy stored at 3-4. Here they are. And then I need to apply the group multiply of 1 and 4, and the group multiply of 2 and 5, and the group multiply of 3 and 6. Here is how it's done. And at the same time, I need to do it for the other Rademeister move. I hit enter to print the result, and the two results are the same. Therefore, it's an invariant of under Rademeister moves. By the way, so this is actually an instance of divide and conquer, because rather than proving the invariance as a global invariant of a knot, I just had to show it for a tiny piece of the knot, okay? Finally, let's do 817. So, first of all, I start by making a product of all the crossings in 817. So, it's a 16 by 16 matrix, most of whose rows and columns are zero, so I'm only printing the non-zero rows and columns and their labels. This is the matrix. It's very similar to the usual matrices you see in Alexander theory. Okay? Then I take this matrix beta, and for k running from 2 to 10, I apply the group multiplication operation in which I multiply 1 and k and store the result in 1. Why stop at 10 rather than continue all the way to 16? because I wanted to show you what an intermediate piece of the computation looks like. This is the result of the tangle, this is the invariant of the tangle that you will get by doing the first 10 gluings that make up 817, but not doing the remaining 6. Here is the invariant, ugly as hell. Okay? Then I take the resulting beta and I do the same, but now for k running from 11 to 16, and I get this matrix. Look at the omega part of it. And at the same time that you're looking at it, James Weddell Alexander is looking at it also with a satisfied look, because when you use the standard software to compute the Alexander polynomial, it comes out the same thing. Okay? So again, it's not that you're supposed to follow it. You're just supposed to appreciate that this is basic arithmetic, and it's much more efficient than anything, or much more compact than anything else there is for Alexander for tangles. Okay, where does it come? Okay, where does it come from? So the accidental answer, I explained it already before, right? I came to it by an accident. And the accidental answer is that this is a symbolic calculus for a natural reduction of the unique homomorphic expansion for W tangles. I don't think I want to say what all these things are right now. So I guess I'll skip all the explanations. I will only say that this is a reduction of something which in itself is a reduction of V tangles, and there are good reasons to think, very good reasons to think, that this is just a special case of a bigger story. Okay? So I guess that's what I said here, but I will not give you any details. Let me also say that really the invariant extends to two-dimensional objects in R4, and these are just pictures that represent them, but I'm running out of time. And let me also tell you that there is a long to-do list. Okay? And the first question on my to-do list is, where does this come from more simply, without having to know about universal finite typing, or universal homomorphic expansions of W knots? If at the end the result is just elementary operations on matrices, or high school level operations on matrices, there ought to be a way to derive it at high school level. I don't know what it is. It would be great to remove all the denominators from these formulas, if only because people who want to categorify things don't like denominators. Okay? Let me also secretly tell you that this is a potentially an extremely good candidate for an invariant to be categorified. And the reason is exactly that all intermediate steps make sense. Part of the reason why it's very hard to categorify the Alexander polynomial is because we don't understand the determinants. We don't know how to categorify determinants as a whole. And the steps along the computation, when you do the computation of a determinant, nobody expects them to be categorifiable, because they don't correspond to anything geometric. Here, things, the intermediate steps do correspond to geometric things, so there is a reasonable likelihood that the whole story can be categorified. Okay? But the first step to doing 7 would be to do 2, which is to remove all the determinants, all the denominators, sorry. And I guess there is more, but I'm out of time, so I'll end with my normal propaganda. And beyond my normal propaganda, there is a full page, a full sheet, 2 sides of extra propaganda on your handout. So I'll stop here. Keep it for the questions.
Questions or comments?
Yeah.
So for example, you're only interested in omega, right?
At the end, in the case of the Alexander polynomial, I'm only interested in omega. But for the multivariable Alexander polynomial, you need the rest of the matrix as well. Now,
let's focus on this one. I'm just looking at the decorations from your first page, and omega mostly, enjoys itself, except only one operation, smoke, where it actually takes something from the matrix.
Yeah.
So, is it not too wasteful? Basically, you're interested only in one end at the end, and it is not that much affected by it. You really have to carry the
component. So, is it too wasteful? Let me give you two answers. First of all, I am not confident that the formulas written here are the best there are. So these formulas started more complicated, and I've gone through a number of steps of changing variables, switching my notation, blah blah blah, until it converged to this, and this is the simplest I have. It may well be that it can be simplified further. Okay, so that's one answer, but the real answer is actually in the other direction. So when I said wasteful. When I said that this invariant is not wasteful, I didn't mean it in the sense that the formulas are extremely clean. They aren't. I only meant that. Okay. You know what? Maybe this is still wasteful, but it's a huge improvement relative to the exponential amount of waste you have to live through. If you try to generalize the Alexander polynomial to tangles by any other means that I know.
Perhaps what I meant is whether you really need to carry the rest of n minus 1 times n minus 1 matrix.
Yes. The answer is yes. I mean, at least I need to carry the rest. So, indeed, the only place where omega change is where you multiply it by epsilon here. But this epsilon is 1 plus alpha. Alpha is one of the entries of the matrix. And this entry gets transformed, pushed around when you do all these other operations. So yes, you do need the whole matrix.
But for example, we cannot make all swaps in advance. And for example, if you are sure that for now on you will not have any swaps whatsoever,
then you could stop. Correct.
Then you can forget
Yes. And in fact, I multiply my multiplication procedure was to multiply in this order, right? But the metagroup is associative. I could have multiplied in any other order. I could have assembled this knot from its pieces in any other way I wish, and I'll get the same answer. And it's possible that other ways of assembling it will be. Will give you cleaner intermediate formulas or something, but in a sense that's somehow the point, right? When you compute a determinant via Gaussian elimination, the thing along the way don't make sense. Here, the ways to compute the invariant precisely correspond to the ways of writing this knot as a union of smaller pieces. And every piece of the computation is the invariant of one of these smaller pieces. Yes?
Well, in the case of the NOSC, it does include containing more information than Alexander polynomial, right?
No. In the case of knots, in the case of knots, right, you get omega on the upper left, and that's the Alexander polynomial, yes. And there remains a single residual matrix entry, and it is computable from the self-linking number.
But it's still, you get excited because it's cleanest, it's less,
it's
more compact.
Well,
let me just try to find.
Sorry, it's not sort of the extra information is just the linking number. It's not good or bad. And in terms of kind of wastefulness, a factor of two, having to store another register where in which you store the self-linking number, I mean, it doesn't count. It's nothing. And the point is that, when I say that this is a compact invariant of tangles, I mean that it has just a polynomial number of entries, a square of entries, and not an exponential number of entries. The little remainder thing at the end is really not much. Sorry, I'm not sure if I even replied to your question. It did say something.
I'm just trying to understand why you are excited about this.
Because it's for tangles.
Because it's an invariant for tangles.
Okay.
It is much more compact than anything else that I know. And every step along its computation, well, doesn't make sense topologically, but is the invariant of something. And we still have to make sense of what does this measure, okay? But at least I know that every step along the computation means something, as opposed to, again, determinants where the steps along the computations are completely random.
Thank you. So what's your wildest view about the whole construction? You didn't invent it just for the Zeller model.
There are two dreams, okay? One is that was supposed to be a baby version of some bigger story about V and W. And you know, I've told this story in various places before without details, and the story is was always computationally difficult, and this is a baby version in which it is more computationally passable, but I actually learned something in doing it. I didn't tell you where, because I didn't tell you how this came about, but I think I learned how to do such computations. So that's one answer. And you know, there is also the crowd pleaser. Sorry for being such a big. I mean, you can always dream about categorifying it.
No, but it's still defined of Alexander theorem.
What?
It is a categorifying of the Alexander theorem.
It would be a categorification of the Alexander polynomial, potentially. Well, extended to tangles, well behaved under tangle compositions, and you know, like me, what the advantage of that might be. Okay.
What other sorts of dot invariants?
I can't hear you.
What other sorts of invariants might this sort of construction work for? I mean, could you get like coefficients of the joint?
Potentially, yes. So, I mean, I kind of know where to start in order to potentially get the Jones polynomial in a similar way. It may or may not succeed. It may completely fail. I don't know. But the same... I'm not sure I want to add more. Possibly also, there may be a similar story for the Jones polynomial.
More questions? Comments? Let Frank speak again.